This is United We Strike Radio on the International Community Radio Network. Don't buy, don't comply, ask why. UnitedWeStrike.com Radio.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Malignant Humour with your host, Vinny Eastwood from New Zealand. That's right. There's a whole lot of anti-New World Order activists all over the world, and we aim to bring the Kiwi contingent of that particular scoria to your ears for your listening pleasure tonight. And incidentally, because this is an international worldwide movement, we wind up having people who immigrate to New Zealand and then wind up loving the country and then finding out that it's full of New World Order type scumbags and trying to stop them from getting their way. One of such people that we have available here today, very glad to have him because he's a very busy man, is Vince Seymour. Vince, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Vinny. Good afternoon.
Would you be able to quickly divulge just who you are to the listeners and also plug your website there?
I'm the publisher of the legal news website, www.kiwisfirst.co.nz. And what I do is I print the legal news stories, which the mainstream media are basically not allowed to print because of the huge and pervasive suppression orders that pervade much of what the court's business is in New Zealand.
Can I just ask you, in terms of structure of a national economy or just how a country runs, how important is it to have a judiciary that's not corrupt?
Well, I think it's essential. I think that's one of the hallmarks of any democracy, is to have a transparent and a just court system. Of course, in New Zealand, we're threatened, first of all, because the courts are not transparent. Anybody who's been in court realizes that much of the court's business is done in secret, and what business is done in public often is hampered by suppression orders of the judge, which keeps it from being printed in the media. And in fact, the huge story in over the last 4 years was the case of the so-called Uriara terrorists, which were most of the charges were dropped this last September. But for 4 years, that's been mired in the courts, where 18 people, I think originally it went down to 14, were charged with weapons and gang violations.
Well, isn't that nice of them?
The courts
themselves, how long have you actually been doing this, Vince?
I've been doing it. The website's been around for 4 years now, and there's well over 300 stories on the website, as well as backgrounds on all the high court judges, which includes the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court. The irony is that I'm the only one facing prison out of those so-called terrorist charges, and it's only because I reported a judgment last year that the judge had denied them trial by jury.
This would be the judgment where 7 out of the 9 search warrants issued for the people who were arrested were ruled to be unlawful.
Yeah, the majority of them were ruled to be unlawful. The Court of Appeal overturned that, and then it was before the Supreme Court. And while that was going on, a judge, Helen Winkleman of the Auckland High Court, denied trial by jury for all the defendants on the basis that it was too complex for a New Zealand jury to understand, and they would probably get it wrong. And, of course, she suppressed her decision to where the people of New Zealand, the public of New Zealand, could not even know that she had denied them trial by jury. And there was no reasoning for it. She gave no reasons, as a matter of fact. It's just part of the whole corrupt system, is that we have no transparency in the courts, and as long as we have that, people's rights are being fundamentally deprived.
Can you think of a context or perhaps a historical instance where this kind of lack of transparency has existed?
Well, I think any oppressive regime, that's how it all starts. I mean, that's the first thing that happens, basically, is that you lose transparency into the inner workings of government. And once that happens, then it's a slippery slope to an extreme oppression and tyranny, and that's just history. Every such totalitarian regime has been has followed that path, basically.
Great. So you see, this is the difficulty. It's a historical context that, hey, if you want to act in a criminal fashion, as many governments do throughout history, as you said, and quite rightly so, the judiciary is the first to go. Because, after all, if you're running the country on a criminal-type basis, hey, the first thing you really need to do is to have the judges in your back pocket so they don't send you to jail. And more to the point, send the people who are exposing your scumbaggery to jail first.
Well, I'll tell you how bad the whole transparency issue is, and it all begins with this, as I've mentioned. In New Zealand now, you cannot get copies of the transcript from the Court of Appeal unless you're even if you're a party to the proceeding. And they've come up with a whole host of spurious reasons. I've seen a number of cases where the judges of the Court of Appeal have refused to release the transcripts because they said it costs money. And they've maintained that as a reason for not providing the transcript, even where the party has offered to pay for it. So they have no reason. They're just coming up with anything that comes to their head as far as a reason not to give the parties copies of the transcripts. And the real, real problem with that is that's the basis of any court system. Why keep a record if you can't? You can't have access.
Well, the point is it has to be a court of record. Now, here's the question, and this is the riddle. You know, riddle me this. How do you have a court of record where no record is kept?
I know. That's an expression you're hearing more and more in New Zealand as more people realize that that's what's going on. And, in fact, there's a soundbite on the website of a judge that I surreptitiously recorded in the Auckland High Court some 4 years ago, 2008, where he was refusing to keep a record. And when he asked why a record was required, that response was given to him, isn't this a court of record? And his response was that a court of record was a phrase coined many centuries ago before the advent of recording devices. So it just goes to show how ridiculous they come up with excuses for not keeping a record. But as I mentioned, it's worse than that. Even where they're by law compelled to keep a record, such as a court of appeal hearing, it takes an act of God to get a copy of it. And that's just ridiculous. And it's insane.
Yeah, well, only if you're a reasonable, decent person, whereas if you're a sociopathic criminal, on the other hand, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
And, hey, can I ask you, how deep does the rabbit hole go on this one? I mean, is there like a degree of nepotism or some form of oligarchy throughout the court system in New Zealand? I mean, it's a fairly small judiciary, isn't it?
There's some 54 high court judges in New Zealand. That includes all the judges of the high court, as well as the Court of Appeal and the Supreme Court. So it's a relatively small number, but it's much more incestuous than just this the small number. Just on the Court of Appeal alone, you have two cousins and a husband and wife. And even the ones that aren't directly related by blood are often in business relationships together. So it's very incestuous. But getting a record again is ought to be standard practice, especially if you're a party to the proceeding. And Transparency International recognizes this as a central tenet of fighting corruption is you must have transparency. They recognize that everything hinges around transparency in order to fight corruption. In New Zealand, we've taken an opposite position, and that is that corruption doesn't exist, so let's keep everything secret. It's quite inconsistent, really.
Well, surprisingly, the New Zealand public actually buy that.
Well,
don't
they
think, oh, it's clean, green, little New Zealand. There's nothing bad going on. There's no grand corruption. There's nothing going on whatsoever. It's almost like we have a nation of naivete.
Well, that shows the effectiveness of the propaganda, really. But if I tell you, Vinny, the people who feel that way almost universally have had no experience with the court. You know, it's like I had a friend who was an exile of Romania, and he said that that when he was young, the radios were full of how, you know, wonderful the economy was and everything. He says, it was wonderful hearing that on the radio until you looked out your window and you realized that the reality was the exact opposite. He says that's what it is here in the courts. You hear all this propaganda about how great the judges are and how transparent the courts are and how fair they are. And that's all well and good as long as you don't walk into a courtroom and see what's actually going on. You don't see, and if you don't do that, you don't see how secretive it is. You don't see how incestuous it is that these judges are ruling in favor of their family members.
The judges are ruling in favor of their family members. Isn't it like a direct conflict of interest if you walk into a courtroom and it's like your brother who's the judge?
Well, absolutely. In fact, judges by law aren't supposed to do that. But I tell you, my first experience with a lawyer in court, my lawyer actually told me as we were walking to court that the judge who was hearing the case wouldn't be allowed to hear it in law. And I asked him why, and he said because he was involved in a case a year before her where she ruled in favor of her brother-in-law and hadn't even disclosed the relationship. And I said, are you kidding me? And he says, no. So when he went in there, he told the judge that she was the subject of an act of complaint that he had put in against her for ruling in favor of her brother-in-law in that earlier case, and she had to recuse herself, and she just said, I'm not recusing myself. I'm not disqualifying myself. I'm going to hear this case. It was just the arrogance is something, again, that goes far beyond the secretive and incestuous nature of the court. They have no integrity when it comes to these issues. They don't have any reservation ruling in favor of their brother or sister or other family member and then telling you to stuff it when you catch them.
Yeah.
There's nobody who holds them accountable, basically.
Well, except you, Vince.
Well, and I've had more than a few people tell me that's why I'm going to prison, because I'm actually exposing these relationships. But it's something that has to be done.
Yeah, absolutely. And we have another big fan of yours who's just joined the line here. We're only having a quick 15 minutes with Vince, and we'll be getting on to our next guest, Penny Bright. So thank you very much, Vince, for joining us on the United We Strike radio broadcast today. Definitely, yep. Ladies and gentlemen, check out his website, kiwisfirst.com.
Thank you, Benny. Have a good day.
You too, Vince. Okay, our next guest here is Penny Bright, coming out live from Auckland. Penny, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vinny. Yeah.
Just for those folks, those international ears listening, could you give us a little bit of background or about yourself and plug your website?
Okay, I'm media spokesperson for the Auckland Water Pressure Group, which, has become quite well known internationally for our campaign of direct action fighting for the basic human right to water and our campaign against the commercialisation and privatisation of water services in Auckland. Our very famous water pressure group, Turn On Squad, as it were, we used to make sure that when people disputed and refused to pay their water bills and as punishment, their attempts made to restrict their water meter or remove their water meter or actually dig up the street and remove the pipes. We would unrestrict the water meters, put in connections to replace water meters, and on a number of occasions we actually dug up the street, replaced the pipes, poured concrete over the pipes, and then they ran out of plumbing options and we actually won a very significant law change which made it unlawful for any council law or council-controlled organisation or any water company in New Zealand to try to disconnect water supplies for non-payment of disputed bills. That was a big victory.
Yeah, absolutely. And ladies and gentlemen, you can see Penny in action actually doing that. If you go to YouTube and you use the search term, Getting Your Water Turned Back On, 101. That's getting your water turned back on 101. It's an instructional video of how to use an angle grinder to cut off the clamps that they use to restrict your water when you don't pay, because human water is a human right. How can you live without it? You can't. You can't wash your kids. You can't wash your hands. You can't do nothing. Okay. So if they're going to be restricting your access to water supplies, so it's down to just a trickle, it's unlawful and it's against your human rights. Ergo, you've got perfect justification to damage their property and get access back to your water supply. Is that about right, Penny?
Yeah, basically just reminding everybody out there that we actually formally disputed. We put it in writing our reasons why we weren't paying this water bill, and we backed it up with direct action. But, since that, I'm now quite active on the anti-corruption front. And, yeah, we found out the root cause of corruption is privatisation. How's it decided who gets the contracts? So, being very involved, been to a Transparency International conference in 2010 and found out they seem to be completely missing the point, and they're not focused on the root cause of privatisation, and they are continuing to perpetuate the myth and the rot and the fraud that New Zealand is perceived to be the least corrupt country in the world. And I'm sorry, that ain't the case. Anyway, been involved in quite a lot of work there and really want to really focus on fighting white-collar crime, corruption and corporate welfare, because that's how the greedy, wealthy and the corporate 1% get away with it.
And your website is waterpressure.wordpress.com. That's waterpressure.wordpress.com. One thing I wanted to talk to you about, Penny, is actually the local government in New Zealand and just how much of a stinking, festering pool of scumbaggery that is.
Yeah, sure. The fact of the matter is that both in central government and local government in New Zealand, we had the Rogernomics neoliberal mantra that public is bad, private is good, which was behind pushing for the privatisation of local and central government services. But it was just a myth, and they just kept repeating this mantra. And when you ask, well, where's the evidence that proves that all this contracting out of services that used to be provided in-house, where's the evidence that it is actually cheaper? Because if it is cheaper at local government, how come every year the rates go up? And if it was so efficient, wouldn't you think the rates would go down? And especially people from the USA, marvellous research being done by Project on Government Oversight, POGO, and September last year they did this groundbreaking research after 3 years studying at USA federal government level 550 service activities, and what they worked out was contracting out was basically twice as expensive as in-house provision. So cut out the contractors and you could save a fortune. Yeah, so what they worked out with the USA federal government, that basically a $500 billion USA federal government budget could be sliced in half, $250 billion to be saved by cutting out the contractors. And so arguably, if those figures are similar in New Zealand, an $82 billion central government spend could be cut in half by $40 billion, and that would be ongoing year after year. There's some big figures there. And how come so few people are talking about it?
Well, namely because when people do talk about it, it either gets swept under the rug or you get demonised as being some left-wing crazed activist.
Well, I mean, local government is the same. There's so many consultants and private contractors providing a whole host of services that used to be provided in-house. Well, once upon a time, local government used to be sort of about rates, rats and rubbish, pretty much. And now there's all manner of stuff that's covered by local government. But the services haven't improved. And, I mean, it's not like fixing the roads or fixing the footpaths or the water pipes or whatever. It's not like that's once in a blue moon that sort of work's going to be happening. It's ongoing. So why on earth are we allowing all these private piggies in the middle with their snouts in the trough ripping off all this hard-earned ratepayer money? Who's benefiting?
Well, I find it ironic, Penny, is that when you say that to people, even people who work in that particular industry, particularly contractors, it's like you're speaking Cantonese to them. They're like, what?
Well, I mean, I still as an Auckland mayoral candidate, and if people want, there's some background information on that website, actually, www.pennybrightformayor.org.nz, and also Stop the Super City, www.stopthesupercity.org.nz, and there's a whole stack of information and photos and videos, etc., helping to explain how this whole corporate takeover by saying, oh, we need efficiencies. As soon as you hear that word efficiency, your alarm bell should start ringing, because efficiency is just corporate speak for we want to get our filthy hands on it.
Well, the Germans in World War II were also very efficient.
Yeah. Did you want to touch on the food bill at all, Vinny? Because I've actually got some new information I haven't actually talked about.
Shoot, Penny. Shoot. Go for your life. I always love what you've got to say.
Okay. Well, people may or may not be aware that New Zealand has a food bill where purportedly it's for food safety. It's nearly 400 pages. But the question is, where's the fire? Where is this great crisis in food safety? Because when you actually bother to check the facts, you find out in New Zealand in 2009, the number of people who reportedly died from foodborne illness, the number was 6 people. And yet when you compare 1998, which was the last year that reports were publicly available for deaths, reported deaths from adverse reactions to pharmaceutical drugs, guess how many? 1998. You already know, Avani. 1,524 reported deaths in New Zealand from adverse reactions to pharmaceutical drugs. Now, that's probably 3 times the road toll. And not only that, it gets worse. That reported deaths by mistakes made by doctors and medical staff in little old New Zealand in 1998 was 4,222. So when you add together death by doctor and death by drugs together, you've got nearly 6,000 reported deaths. So, you know, ask yourself, where's the crisis? Is it a food safety crisis or a patient safety crisis? But what the new information that I've got is there is actually a human right to food, and where you can find that is in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, 1948, Article 25, and it states, everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself, sexist language, and of his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care, and necessary social services, blah, blah. But that's the guts of it. That's where the right to food is entrenched as a basic human right. Now, what happened was the right to food was further codified in 1966 in Article 11 of the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, an international treaty which entered into force in 1976 and is legally binding upon the 150 states which have ratified it. Well, guess what? New Zealand has ratified it. And the most extensive legal effort to clarify the content of the right to adequate food is in the General Comment 12 to Article 11.2, which was adopted in 1999 by the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, the supervisory mechanism of the International Convention on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. And it states, quote, the right to adequate food is realized when every man, woman and child, alone or in community with others, has physical and economic access at all times to adequate food or means for its procurement. And just one last point there, because I know it's slightly heavy, the legally sort of wording here, but it says, the obligation to respect requires states not to take any measures preventing access to adequate food. Thus, while states do not have a duty to distribute food to all their citizens, they may not interfere with individuals' own efforts to provide for themselves. So in my considered opinion, the New Zealand Food Bill, where they want to tighten up and make be obstructive in the ability of people to provide food for themselves through this food bill, I believe that's, in my opinion, a violation of the basic human right to food. And that's something I really want to make a fuss about because, I mean, you know, it's just, I know that the United Nations is an organisation fraught with contradiction, but there are there are bits of it that are good, and I believe that the international, the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is a fine and upstanding document, and there's a lot of good stuff in there. And if you don't stick up for the rights you're supposed to have, you lose them.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's a universal truth. And human rights are something which cannot be taken away, basically, or at least technically should not be able to be taken away, but they do all the time, don't they?
Well, sorry, jumping around slightly here, but yeah, when you do this research, God, it's fascinating, but here's a couple of tips for people. Always go to source. Get your facts from the horse's mouth. So what I did, I went to where I was interested in finding out, well, where are the figures currently now in New Zealand for reported deaths from adverse reactions to pharmaceutical drugs and deaths because of mistakes from doctors and medical staff? And what I did, I contacted CALM, which is the Centre for Adverse Reaction Monitoring in New Zealand. And I found to my absolute horror that it's not mandatory to report adverse reactions to pharmaceutical drugs like vaccines, etc. I mean, they've got lovely forms there that people can fill out, but there's no lawful mandatory requirement to make people fill them out. So it's not just reported deaths, which are still a matter of great mystery since 1998, but in terms of the people that didn't die, but whose health was seriously affected. How many of those are there? And how will we know and get an accurate figure if it's not mandatory to report adverse reactions? And that also goes...
On the other hand, the people who are actually encouraging this, nursing staff, doctors, etc., they get that kind of mantra of vaccines are safe and effective, vaccines are safe and effective. You go and you ask them, can you name me one ingredient that's in those vaccines?
They have no clue.
Well, that's something I found out during the swine flu scam, which you were the person that actually got me sort of, you know, a bit more knowledgeable about that. But I mean, we had a huge campaign in New Zealand, which was actually very successful. But what happened was I did an Official Information Act request to our Minister of Health, and I got confirmed that basically MedSafe, which is the body from the New Zealand Ministry of Health who's tasked with making sure medicines are safe, they rely on the data sheets from the vaccine manufacturers. So where's the independent double check? I mean, hello? How on earth does that work?
It doesn't, is the answer. And we have our next guest on now, Penny. So I'd like to thank you very much for coming on. And if you'd like to give us a brief sum up of what you're about to say, go for your life.
Just that the point that I want to make is that internationally we need to move from a health system based on sickness to one based on wellness, because if everybody was fit and healthy, then there's a lot of people in the medical profession and big pharma who would be losing a lot of money.
Yeah, indeed. Penny Bright, ladies and gentlemen, hardcore lady. If you look at her website, waterpressure.wordpress.com, and she can actually, a lot of the stuff that she's uncovered in New Zealand, as we all know about the New World Order, it is applicable virtually everywhere, and you can save yourself a lot of time researching if you simply go to the people who've done it already. So thank you, Penny, and you have yourself a fabulous day.
Thank you, Vinny. Okay, cheers. Bye.
My next guest, ladies and gentlemen, is Ben Vidgen from PostmanProductions.com. Ben, welcome to the program.
Hey, Vinny, how are you doing there? It's what are we going to talk about today?
Well, I wanted you to just sort of introduce yourself first of all and give people a little bit of background.
Okay, well, I'll give you the very brief condensed version. I'm the editor of a newspaper down in South Island called the Deadline Gazette. That's been in existence for about 8 years. I'm the author of two books, State Secrets 2 and State Secrets 1, which was bestseller in 1999. I think we did about 15,000 copies, which in New Zealand is a very small country, so if you're American listening, then add a couple of zeros onto it to give you context. Degree in political science, specialising in political violence and counter-terrorism, 6 years in the territorials or army reserves, attached to artillery intelligence and other intelligence-related postings. I run the website, www.postmanproductions.org, and I generally like sort of sticking my nose in where it's not appreciated and commenting on things that authorities said rather I didn't. And I think yesterday we were talking about sort of such things as the MV Arena, HARP, and a couple of other issues as well. So I've sort of made a couple of notes here if you want to go back and cover that some material, or if you want to move on to some other sort of subjects, I'm more than happy. You lead and I'll follow.
Well, you seem to move fast, Ben, and that's what I like about you. When it's the Deadline Gazette, and it quite literally is, because I don't know. It seems like you're always in a rush, but you're never stressed out about it, and that's why you get the information so quickly and you explain it so concisely. Updates even as far as yesterday, for those who are unaware, on the international stage, the MV Rena is a giant container ship that has lodged itself on an incredibly well-charted reef as it ploughed into it at full speed when it should have been going port speed. And it's been lodged there for like 3 months, and the cleanup effort goes on. Incidentally, it was a ship flagged in Liberia, which has incredibly lax international shipping standards under maritime law, where a lot of ships go to get certified so that they basically don't have to do their maintenance properly. And it has something like a $4 billion payout or some ridiculous amount of money paid out for its insurance on this. So there's a lot of motives, there's a lot of red flags, and what we talked about yesterday was some of the scary, censored kind of cargo that's aboard that ship. If you could elaborate on that, that'd be nice.
Well, as we were talking about yesterday, like, you know, in terms of the arena, was that, here was a ship going full speed. There was at least one blog at the time that suggested this was deliberately. What's interesting was that the writer of that blog was basically told to shut up. He works in the salvage operation, so it was a case of he had a vested interest and wasn't able just to report any further. The Dominion Post did a follow-up story where they quote a source which was either the same person or someone very similar. They addressed most of the issues that he dealt with in the story and basically corroborated them. And to date, no one else had actually picked up any of those, you know, claims, which are pretty serious claims, and disputed them or refuted them. You know, on board, we said, we're looking at some of the substances, and what we're finding was that when we're dealing with the maritime services, I'd go to them, find out anomalies on their website, come back, and they would come back and change the answer every time I actually did so. Subsequently, I sort of found myself losing more and more faith in their transparency and their integrity. It is interesting because I had a couple look on a few other sites last night, and there is some pretty good scientific work pointing out the fact that, you know, this is going to be a long-term environmental hazard. For maritime services, people like Nick Smith, who's he's a member of a political party, to downplay it. I mean, they've just been downright dishonest, and you know, hopefully it comes back to bite them in the ass with some lawsuits. On that point, what I understand is that some of the volunteers that are involved in the project, there's negotiations about them getting some compensation or some repayment for their time and effort. My advice to any of those people signing anything that's involved with this event is get it checked out by your lawyer, because you may find that it actually contains clauses which prevent you from taking any legal action. As you pointed out in the a number of disasters that have occurred overseas, Gulf of Mexico, and I think it was the Van, feel free to jump in and correct my pronunciation, but the Valdez, you know, most of those people, the Valdez are no longer alive anymore. So if you suddenly find that you're involved in the cleanup, or, and you do get seriously ill, which there is a potential, you know, I'm not a medical person. I'm simply relying on information, but you know, I wouldn't be down on the beach cleaning that material. If you do get asked to sign something, well, check it out, because you may find that it may prevent you from taking legal action down the road. Again, one of the things I ask people to say is, like, you know, look at the way that the Army turns up the situation. You know, they're all dished out in disposable, you know, suits. It's not there to sort of stop them from getting dirty. Been in the Army for 6 years, you know, dirtiness is not something that soldiers actually worry about. If you get given kit, it's given them for a reason. And so, you know, you're down there in your flip-flops and you're picking up stuff without gloves on or a mask, and you look at what the Army guys are, I'd ask yourself long and hard, why is it actually occurring? From there, we jumped into the subject of core exit. We looked at how, apart from being used for the subject of oil dispersal, it's actually also used for oil exploration. It's a nano-engineered emulsifier, being a substance which is literally designed to grind material down. Nano-engineering basically is when you're dealing with objects the tenth of an atom size. So we're talking about very nasty toxic metals mixing with other chemicals. This is what people are actually ingesting. The laboratory reports just along on nanoparticles is pretty negative. So when you put another chemical suit, it's another cause for concern. In terms of exploration, you know, what we find is when we look in the Gulf of Mexico, and issues of fracking, it's used to actually literally rip off sections of the earth to actually expose to get access, easy access for oil. And wherever you look around the world, you know, where there's fracking, there are earthquakes. And increasingly, the literature out there is actually pretty damn certain fracking equals earthquakes. Some people go out there and say, you know, the science is, you know, still out. Well, I would say to you, when you're looking at the scientists who are saying for or against, take a good hard look at who's paying the checkbooks. I think you'll find that most of the scientists that are trying to dip a little actually are working for the oil companies.
They're either fracking crazy or they're fracking bored off.
Well, you know, bought off is a strong word, but, you know, everyone likes to pay their rent and pay their mortgages. And when you're putting that interest, you know, it's very easy for you to start looking at things in a way that maybe you're not being as selective as you should be. You know, whereas we're talking also about the situation in Christchurch, we found out some pretty interesting information about apparently some fault movements. I've gone back and spoken to two of the sources that approached me. One of the sources, I'm not actually having as much faith in as I used to. He put out some stuff on the Facebook yesterday. To be fair, you know, saying, look, you know, this is not for me. But, you know, what he was putting out there was just a whole bunch of crap, basically. And you know, that's, you're going to have to come up with something. You've got to back it up. And saying that, you know, there is the issue of, one of the things that we looked at was the issue of, you know, Christchurch becoming volcanic in relation to the situation. Again, I ran this past my geologist. Looked at one of the more common sites that are actually out there, which was written by an engineer. My geologist source here at Canterbury University said basically, said, well, I don't rate that, but go and have a look at the site above Top Secret. Apparently, we just go, you know, volcanic activity, Christchurch, above Top Secret. You should be able to find it quite easily. That source basically sums it up, says, look, there's some really reasonable arguments for and against there on that particular site about the issue about whether Christchurch is getting, you know, becoming more volcanic. Again, I'll let people go and actually have a look at that material subject. What is interesting, however, is when we look at the more current recent earthquake activity, and one of the things that we were talking about was the series of forensic signatures that I'm sort of, you know, looking at towards saying, well, you know, whether these earthquakes are man-made or natural. And we had covered a whole bunch of other subjects, but, you know, another one actually popped up, which was back in, I think, the February quake, New Zealand musician Tri Lyon, one of a series of great New Zealand musicians, including Don McLashans and Sharon Lang and Herbs, which put out some great political-based music. But Tri Lyon, which is www.trilyon.co.nz, does a really good piece on the Christchurch earthquake, and he points out that there were these seismic monitoring vessels out there.
Trillion.
Thank you very much. I love it. You know, with my little dyslexia, I am prone to the occasional benism, so feel free to correct me at any stage. But now I have no objections to that. So, you know, he pointed out these connections between these seismic-based vessels that were in Christchurch at the time. Well, guess what? When we had the earthquakes in December and in Wellington, and later on in Virginia in Christchurch, we just happened to have another one of these vehicles cruising off the surface. And that was called the Polaris. Emerald, but if you just basically go seismic vessel, you'll find that the material there, and there's a really good article on Stuff at www.stuff.co.nz, Big Quake Fails to Stop Texan Oil Giant, which points out the fact that not only have we do we allow companies to come in and start doing oil exploration, which are going to be using fracking, but they've actually also been using these vessels, which the article did connect to previous earthquake activity. So, again, it's all part of that pattern of we're not just seeing what's happening now. We saw it happen all again, and it wasn't just one thing. You know, we're seeing about 15, 16 different, you know, factors that all pointed towards the fact that these guys know what they're doing. And, you know, the question, of course, you know, for the people who may not be familiar with it is that there is a shitload of oil in the Southern Basin. And, of course, this is actually, you know, fairly old news. Back in the 80s, there was a file released the Opal Files. That particular file, you know, it was basically pointing out the fact that, you know, the powers that be knew that this oil was down there. They planned to come down there. They planned to actually access this resource and basically buy out New Zealand. Now, at the time when this document was released, the theme at the time in the media was that, oh no, there was no oil in the Southern Basin. You know, people would laugh at the Opal Files. Now, when they started came back to the whole issue about 3 or 4 years ago, which, you know, came out very slowly, first in the South Island and has only now really hit the national media, you know, the story then became, oh, we always knew that oil was there, but, you know, gosh, it was too expensive to actually pull out of the ground. Well, in that time, in 1977, oil was at $14 US dollars a barrel. Today, well, at the time when this all occurred, oil was around about $100. Okay, in theory, you're looking at about a $70 increase, but when you turn around, you do take the inflation into account, and you imagine what you went into a shop in 1977 with a $20 bill, and then you went into a shop today with a $20 bill now and tried to buy the same thing, you'll pretty much find that the inflation actually balances up quite. So that whole argument of wasn't cost effective, that is actually pretty much actually crap. You know, the file also is an interesting material because, you know, I've done a lot of research, and again, my good friend Chris Wingate likes to dump on it. Go ahead, Chris. You're welcome. But you know, just you look at the first part of the Opal file, and again, I warn readers, there are three versions of this file in existence. I've only seen one version of online. There is a lot of signs that they have been manipulated. But in saying that, when you do the research, you know, you find that a lot of stuff checks out. A really good example is in the various documents.
Well, Ben, you seem to have dropped out there.
Have I?
Oh, well.
Can you hear me?
Okay, we'll see if we can.
Can you hear me, mate?
Get him back up later on, but basically,
are you there?
Off. All right, and we're back. Sorry about that, ladies and gentlemen. Technical difficulties. Ben,
I'm there. Can you hear me?
All right, now we can hear you. Okay, good on you, mate. So, sorry, right, as you were saying.
Okay, where were we at the stage? We were talking about. Have we got to the Opal file at that stage?
Yes, we had. Yeah.
Okay, well, as I say, like, you know, the document starts off with the fact that they were looking at doing oil drilling. It starts off, you know, the Nelson Bunker Hunt using sophisticated satellite techniques used to detect global deposits, discover huge oil sources of New Zealand, the Great Southern Basin. That one line's really interesting because what you find, if you jump forward to 1977, one of the US scientists had a great idea of actually dumping nuclear waste in Antarctica, and the New Zealand government, Norman Kirk, turned around and said, no, you're not going to do that because you're going to cause flooding. And the documents from the National Archives, and I'll be putting them up on my own website or showing people where they can find them in about, give me about a week or two because I've got a few little issues I need to deal with. But those documents actually show that the DSIR, which is New Zealand Scientific Institute, they were using the technology, which, you know, at the time people said, oh, there is that satellite technology doesn't exist. Well, declassified documents now show that actually it does. And this is actually the same sort of stuff that we're talking about when we start getting into HARP. Material that's used for deep penetration exploration on the mineral reserves. And pretty much all everything that's going on in New Zealand at the moment and in the southern region is about control of those resources, not just in the southern basin, but in terms of access to Antarctica. Simple geography lessons, there are about four places that you can get into Antarctica. New Zealand is the point of difference is that we provide the longest window of opportunity. So if you can control the domestic politics of New Zealand, you pretty much are also controlling the port access to Antarctica and the resources occur. Since in the late 90s, the Americans have actually stuck an entire new base down there. They call it Scott Amundsen, and their press releases, they simply refer to it as Scott Base, which is the name of the existing New Zealand base. They've put this base on New Zealand claimed territory. They've built a 1600 kilometre highway from that base to the existing base at McMurdo. And at the same time, this is all actually going on. The Chinese actually signed a deal with Australians to carry out oil, mineral exploration down in Antarctica. The race is on, and we are the entry point. Control us, and you control the mineral resources of this basically southern hemisphere.
Yeah, so, yeah. The New Zealand itself seems to be a almost, I don't know, I feel it actually is quite an important territory to control, basically. Ironic enough, because, hey, it doesn't really have a whole lot of alleged strategic significance as far as proximity to other nations is concerned. However, because of its isolation, it makes for a very interesting little hot spot of corrupt activity, because when the world's going to Shiite Muslim, they'll most likely come here, you know?
Well, you know, I know you're not necessarily a big fan of the whole issue of global warming, but, you know, one of the things I always point out, and I brought up with the Minister of Science, Pete Hodgins, was I said, well, if you follow the model of global warming, that model basically says that it's going to become harder and harder to carry out economic, a viable economic situation in the Northern Hemisphere. The entire strategic importance under that model, if you believe that model, or at least that's what they're telling us, suddenly makes New Zealand a lot more important. And, you know, when I put this to Pete Hodgins at the time, he turned around and said, yeah, you're completely correct. And this also, you know, deals with the whole issue of the Green Party. They're another advocate of the global warming scenario, yet, you know, their own policy doesn't have any way of how we're going to deal with the geopolitical consequences of this. And leaping forward, at the same time, when you look at what's actually going on, you know, in the last 10 years, New Zealand, the South Island, has just been militarized. There are installations popping up all over the place, which, you know, a good example is one down in Invercargill, which is Tiger, which is again part of the HAARP network. They turn around and tell us it's for astronomy, but when you actually turn around and you do your research, you find out, guess what, it's actually part of the Superdan over the Horizon network, which is its main primary purpose is A, part of the defense network, and B, to provide communications for submarines. You know, all across up the coast of East Coast of New Zealand, you've got the 10X sonar buoy systems, which are again part of the HAARP system. Great Barrier Island, I believe, has an installation there. We know that another one's been stuck into Burnham, which is the main military base in Canterbury. We have Mount John, which is an existing installation, which is, you know, Owen Wilkes, who was original arms investigator back in the 70s, broken, took photographs, had the documentation. It subsequently shut it down because it was shown that it had military connections with the University of Pennsylvania, same university today that receives all the data that comes in from Antarctica. It comes in from a satellite known as, the relay system is known as Marisat GOES. Until recently, the satellite system up there was called F2. It's just changed over recently, but all of that money, that's $500 million worth of communication, not including satellite. That money comes directly from the United States Navy's space and warfare program. Two of their employees, interestingly enough, have just died in Antarctica in 2000. One was Joe Posada, who worked in the communications network system in McMurdo. The network system relates to Vandenberg for Air Force Base and Alaska, the HAARP network at Poker Flats up there. The other one was Rodney Marks, who actually handled all the remote observation that are down in Antarctica. And Rodney Marks' death is currently being treated by the New Zealand police as a homicide. They're not getting any cooperation from either the US Embassy or Raytheon, the missile giants, who actually have now taken over the running of these bases. I mean, if you actually look at Antarctica, there are distinct laws that prevent both mining and militarization, and these laws are being tromped all over. There is very little coverage actually coming out actually onto the subject. And I'm actually quite disappointed in the Green Party that you know, they are not putting more focus to show people how much hardware has been stuck in that area. I mean, there is mainstream sources that show that already China and US are having little tit-for-tats down there and having little satellite wars and spying wars going on down there.
Yeah. Hey, and speaking of military involvement by international interests in New Zealand here, what are the evidence that came up that the Christchurch earthquake in September of, I think, was it 2010? What are the evidence that HAARP was used?
Well, what I'll do, Vinny, is I'll actually backtrack and I'll kind of tell you where I come from. In 2005, Deadline wrote an article relating just after the Indonesian tsunami, because at that time what we noticed was that there were mass reports of sonic booms, fireballs being sighted in the sky. This all coincided at the same, just about 2 weeks before the earthquake in Macquarie Island, which again we have a HAARP station based. And it also occurred at the same time before an 8.0 earthquake occurred a week before the 9.1. A very large mathematical anomaly. At Macquarie Island, they did detect an electrical anomaly. And we're just on a quick point on that. There's been rumours going around that actually there's been installations have been burnt down in Macquarie Island. If anybody out there can actually verify that with, you know, hard material, I'd like to do so, because so far all my attempts to do so have failed. But I'm quite interested to find out what's going on there. But to get back to the whole issue of the Indonesian tsunami, I was actually quite interested in this because when I was in Australia in 1996 or 1995, it was the time that the cult Soarinko, again, I apologize for my pronunciation, but they had just carried out the attack in Tokyo using sarin gas. So this is the same cult that had predicted correctly the earthquake in Kobe, coinciding at the time. Both these events coincided at the time of a very aggressive trade war between the US and Japan. Now, what happened at the time was, what also occurred was that it got discovered that the existence of the cult had actually been in Australia three years before their involvement in the terrorist attack in Japan came to light. Christine Shamrock, who was the MP for the Greens, had asked Nick Balkis at the time, who was the senator, asked him, the Minister of Immigration, said, hey, you know, what's the deal? We've got all this, you know, probably about 30, you know, 40 Japanese people bringing all sorts of really strange equipment into the country, deliberately smuggling it, yet you guys haven't kicked them actually out. You've just let them go on their merry, merry way. Nick Balkis has responded at the time, well, I'll look into that and I'll report back, but I think you're mistaken. Well, 3 years later, it turns out that Christine Shamrock was not only correct, but in actual fact, the cult had actually been under surveillance by the Australian Federal Police. Now, at the same time as Christine was making her original claims, there was a huge fireball sighted over the city of Perth, coinciding at the same time a seismic earthquake occurred 3 kilometres of the west of the Laverton Royal Australian Air Force's electronic warfare station. This epicentre was the exact location of the farm, and a very clever guy out there in Australia, a geologist by the name of Harry Mason, turned around and started digging into this and found out some very interesting results. The consequences of Harry's investigation was that he was asked to speak as a witness at the Australian Senate investigation to whether or not the UM had been carrying out weapons of mass destruction, specifically earthquake-causing weapons, 3 km, you know, west of Laverton. That same material was then regurgitated at the US investigations carried out by Sam Nunn. Sam Nunn is a legend in the intelligence community. You know, this guy is, you know, he's the original smoking cancer man from the X-Files, everyone. Well, both those reports turn around. They didn't say, no, this didn't occur. What they basically did was they issued a public version which said it's unlikely. Not no, but unlikely. Yet, what's interesting is 2 years after the US investigation into this, the Secretary of Defense, William Cohen, gave an address at the Georgetown University where he basically came out and unequivocally turned around and stated, guess what, there are, you know, weapons of mass destruction, and these include weapons that change the weather, cause volcano, and cause earthquakes. He was very specific about it. Some people turned around and said, oh, that transcript has been misquoted. Well, I went to the Pentagon's own website. I dragged out a transcript of it. I think I listed the exact link on my website. Had a look at it, and it's pretty damn clear what he's actually talking about. It's pretty crystal clear. At the same time, if you turn around and you start, you know, Googling words like Australian Department of Defense, electromagnetic energy, what you'll find is that their own EM super weapon is actually based, they say, on Russian technology. Well, it's kind of interesting because what the Australian Federal Police said in their report was that all the equipment that the Japanese cult were using actually came deliberately from the Russians. Now, so having known all of that background history, you know, and having written a story about fireballs and bolides, you know, when I started to see on the front page of the newspaper of Christchurch a fireball just the day before Boxing Day earthquake, I was on Facebook, and I think you might even remember at the time I was saying, hey guys, we're about to get hit. The fireballs weren't the only forensic signatures we were using. All of these factors included dolphins being washed up whales being washed up in large numbers. Whales, they're very sensitive to any disturbances in electromagnetic energy, so that was one factor. As I said, we mentioned the bolides, we mentioned the sonic booms. What we were also looking at was, you know, you had coinciding military exercises occurring just before these events, and everybody had the trucks all loaded up just with the right equipment. Same thing happened in Haiti. Same thing happened in Indonesia, as you said yesterday on your show. So that was another factor, you know. When you go onto my website, I think I list, give or take, I list about 9 of these factors. And as I'm saying today, one of the things that we also noted, which Trillian pointed out, was these seismic vessels that were in Christchurch at the time. Not now, not one, but 2, but 3 earthquakes. These vessels have been operating. So, again, this is part of the whole repeating theme. you know, we put out a series of factors. We need to test them. But so far, the testing is showing that this information is coming back each time. Those factors all come together. We know what the consequences are going to be. Also, very important to make clear to people, you know, we're not saying when these things all occur, run to the hills and cry, oh, my God. We're talking about basic, simple things. Make sure your first aid kit's actually loaded up. Make sure you've got canned food in your kitchen. Make sure that heavy objects are taken off the ground. These are just simply, if you see all these things come together, it's an opportunity to be just a little bit wiser. Forewarned is forearmed.
Yeah, yeah. And we've had a lot of stuff coming up over Facebook. Oh, sorry, I need to pronounce that right. Facebook. Yeah. And Facebook. And basically, I've come to the conclusion, and I think it was actually you that taught me this, that if somebody says one thing, it ain't true until you've got at least two more sources that are completely independent of that first one saying the exact same thing. That's called corroboration, and that's what investigative journalists do, allegedly. And I never claim to be an investigative journalist. I never claim to have credibility. That way nobody can claim that I've lost any.
Well, you know, the other thing is it's not just a case of corroborating information. It's the other term that we use in the military is quantivation versus qualification. So, you know, if you turn around and you say, look, I've got three guys that I met at a bar, that's not good quality information. If you can say, look, you know, we've got three close-up photographs, high resolution, that's good quality information. So it's not just the quantity of the information you're using. You've got to try and find good quality information. And, you know, in terms of, you know, the other thing which to be fair to ourselves is that, you know, we're not dealing with basic, easy subjects. We are dealing with stuff that people don't want us to know about. So, you know, you don't always get it right. You know, you're allowed the occasional to actually slip up. But the reality is I look back at my own history, and I've been doing this for about, you know, 20 years now. You can read my books. You can read what I've written. And then you can turn around and look at what I've written, what's happened in the hindsight. And I've got a pretty, you know, I've got a pretty good strike record. So when I deal with the stuff, you know, I put out the caveat here, you know, don't run to the hills. Just treat it as a little piece of information. Use me as one intelligent source. Go away and find two other group of people to back it up, you know. You know, the other thing which we also talked about was that when we're talking about the reader, we're talking about the radiation issue. And one of the things which I pointed out was that, you know, I went off and spoke to the National Radiation Laboratory and all the other different agencies, and nobody was actually doing any testing. The reason why I'd actually asked was that my own source at the Otago University, and I'm quoting him here, took a swab off the cast after some light rain this afternoon, just on his regular test. It turned a 0.32 microsieverts per hour, mostly alpha and beta wave. It's here. He was talking about radiation. The reading is not particularly huge. It is, however, above normal than what we expect. Again, we spoke to the NRL. So far, they're saying, "Oh, we don't have anything," but we've got a couple of leads up there, and we're going to be following that one actually up. Interestingly enough, again, this is whole talking about the issue of the lack of transparency and the way that these guys treat us as idiots. We've got an article here, WW New Zealand Herald. I won't read you the whole link, but it's basically saying, you know, this radioactive material, because we now think the source is actually Fukushima, it won't reach us. Now, that's a year ago. Today, we've got a case of a report coming from Australia of a radiation cloud off the coast of Australia. Again, the scientists there, official scientists, are trying to downplay it. You know, we'll be doing a little bit more follow-up on that one, actually, as well. But the problem is, you know, when you're dealing with agencies that are meant to give us information, meant to be transparency, they don't. And a good example of that is if you go and have a look at a book, New Zealand, Sorting Fact from Fiction, which is written by Andrew McEwen, who's the professor of worked for the head guy at the National Radiation Laboratory in New Zealand. Great little book. The book should be called Nuclear New Zealand, A Work of Fiction. There's so much in that book that is not mentioned. It doesn't mention that the largest contamination case in New Zealand, which is the contamination of the physics department at Victoria University. This is actually where the Wellington radio station Radioactive gets its name. It doesn't mention the fact that the Cook Strait is actually one of the world's official nuclear dump stations, one of about 15 in the world. To be fair, it's one of the smallest ones, but it's not there. It doesn't mention the fact that in the 1970s, the New Zealand helped cover up a nuclear reactor down in Antarctica called Nukipu. Again, Owen Wilkes, my favourite man, he was the man that covered that story up, broke it open, could not be denied. He had all the documentation, the photos. And they did it again in 2000. You know, the turnaround, Investigate magazine intercepted ham radios talking about the Ministry of Transport helping ship this waste through. Didn't have any other material at that time, but I had a source that turned around and said, you know, I've spoken to the captain of the NV Green Wave. He said, you know, the ship brought back nuclear waste from a nuclear waste. When I turned around and did all my official information act, and that was a huge battle, the National Radiation Laboratory, they lost reports, suddenly material went missing. But the short version was, in the end, they had to commit, yes, that ship was carrying nuclear waste. And then when they turned around and they tried to downplay it, they said it was only low level, they actually did things like they stapled two sheets of separate shipments together to make it look like it was one. It was interesting because I, at the same time, another little trick I used up my sleeve is that I quite often will send an official information act off to not one agency, but two or three, and then I sit back And I wait for the material to come in, and I look at the language that these agencies are giving me, because quite often the language will show whether or not they're actually sitting down and talking. And that's a real – if they start doing that, you know you're on the right track. Well, this is actually what we had. We had Maritime Services, their legal department, we had Ministry of Foreign Affairs, and we had National Radiation Laboratory, all issued me almost an exact duplicate of the same document, except for – I think it was the NRL one that actually made a slip-up because they used the word shipments. And that's when I went after them. And after a long, long, long time, yep, they turned around and said, guess what? There are nuclear reactors down in Antarctica, except for they don't call them reactors. They call them snap generators. Go and have a look at what these things are actually made up of, and you'll find that that's actually semantics. It's not just Fukushima.
Hold on, Ben. We have breaking news here. An SOS message from Occupy Auckland has been issued. The General Assembly was at 4:30. It was about an hour and a half ago. In Aotea Square, they're saying now that they're under siege, and Occupy Albert Park, which is just across from the university, was sabotaged last night, and Merlin from the media tent, his laptop was just stolen, and there is some seriously effed up Shiite Muslim going down. Please get down there if you can and forward this message to all supporters of Occupy Auckland. You know, share this on Facebook. And we need your help now. This is perhaps the most important GA since our inception. Please, united we stand, divided we fall. Occupy will never die, we will only multiply. We are unstoppable, a new world is possible. We are the 99%. Expect us. And that was from the Merlin, the media tent master. So, yeah, if anybody's down there, at Occupy or in Auckland right now, you need to be getting to Aotea Square and Albert Park for the GA continuing on. So there's a little bit of breaking news for you there. And this is also the reason why my guest Joe Carolyn from Occupy has not shown up today, because obviously the laptop that he was going to be doing this interview on was stolen. And I was wondering if Ben, if you've done any research into Occupy at all.
I actually haven't done a great deal of research on the Occupy in terms of, you know, it's not an area I've been focusing on. But what I'll give people a bit of an insight into the Dunedin Occupy movement and how the media has actually treated it. Down in the Dunedin, where the Occupy tents were, what you've actually found was that you had the ODT, which is the major newspaper. It's about 50 metres away from the particular matter. What you'd actually find is that what would happen is that the ODT would turn up when there was meant to be an AGM or whatever. They would turn up early. They'd take the photographs when the crowds hadn't fully arrived, so that when they showed them in the newspaper, they showed less people actually being involved. But they would turn around and issue these rather pompous editorials about, you know, you've had your say, now it's time to move on. And this is the bit that I found really interesting was, you know, when they were making the comments and they went out and they spoke to, you know, experts at the university, and, you know, they never actually went to any of the people in the Occupy movement and actually collectively gave them a chance to present why they were in the first place. Now, that's interesting from twofold, because, you know, two of the people that are down there, Michelle Halliwell and her partner, Karen Tass, these guys have had about 20 years' experience in the finance sector. And if the ODT had been doing the job and chose to speak to these people who weren't students or unemployed people but very successful business people in their own right, they would have found a lot of things about New Zealand and its finance, especially the collapse of South Canterbury Finance and so on, which would have shocked a lot of people. The ODT has a lot of very vested interests in this part of the South Island. They weren't giving them the chance to present that information. Instead, they deliberately misspelled or misrepresented actually what was going on down there in the Occupy movement. So, that was a again, that issue of credibility. You know, when we saw the Occupy movement broke out in New York originally, it was about 2 to 3 months before the mainstream media even actually acknowledged that there were thousands of people there. Meanwhile, this stuff was going on Facebook and, you know, out to people like yourself, Vinny. You know, increasingly, we're seeing that the mainstream media has zero credibility. Fox Corporation, Public Broadcasting Corporation, they're all corporations. They are working for their shareholders, not the public. They're not news bringers. They are sellers of advertising. So the other, of course, the other interesting issue in terms of the Occupy movement was that you're probably not that familiar with what politics of Dineen are. And I won't bore your international readers, but we just recently built, first of all, Dineen's built, it's on a gold town. And in that 150 years, we've amassed $1 billion worth of assets. The council that we have down here in 5 years has blown that all on a football stadium. They've put the city hugely into debt. They have done series after investment, which have done nothing but make property investments and the banks around here are wealthy at the cost of the Dineen ratepayers. And when you get, and these are the subjects of the ODT that are doing the job, should be covering, but instead, when you go down to the football stadium down in Dunedin, you'll see that there's huge adverts from the ODT. You know, these guys get massive amounts of advertising revenue from the very people that cause the majority of the greed in the Otago. And it's a pattern which unfortunately is repeated New Zealand-wide and it's again repeated worldwide.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what Occupy seems to be representing, and that's why it's in, what, a couple of thousand cities now or something like that, or 500 however many it is.
It's pretty huge. But, you know, what it really, really boils down to, and this is the issue which, you know, we did a last issue of the newspaper, we actually ran an article on Occupy, and we used this cartoon, you know, where Uncle Sam's leaning out the window talking to the broadcaster saying, you know, these people don't know what they're here for. And the woman then repeats exactly what he said. The issue that Occupy is, in my mind, is about two things. It's one about accountability. We are sick and tired seen corporations, banks, time after time, rip us off, poison us, kill us, murder us, put us into poverty, and never anything ever actually happens. You know, we don't have due process. We have one law for us and one law for them. The second issue is, at the end of the day, democracy boils down to two basic planks. It's the right to free speech and it's the right to assembly. And if you can't even give us this, then don't call it a democracy. And this is it. You know, what's happening down, I don't know the full situation in Auckland, but, you know, the police down here in New Zealand have done one really good thing, and I'll give them a good handshake. They haven't kicked out the Occupy guys when the council have told to do so, because our law, the Bill of Rights, prevents this from happening. Once that starts happening, that's it. We're not even obeying our own laws. We're actually just making them up as we go along.
Yeah. Well, that's what government's pretty much adept at, isn't it? Well, you know, hey, we don't have any idea what the heck is going on. We're too stupid to read the legislation, so let's just make it up.
Oh, entirely. And it's also, I mean, you have the entire issues, you know, in New Zealand, for example, you know, we have situations where a judge that sits on the High Court and a judge that sits on the District Court shouldn't, in actual fact, ever cross the bridges, you know. But constantly, if you look at who the judges are, you'll find, actually, you've got High Court judges appealing on District Court matters and vice versa. You know, there's a rule book, but we're not even actually following it. We have situations in New Zealand where we have, for example, my favourite one is that, you know, Fonterra is a dirty, nasty little company, and they were involved in the UN Food for Oil affair. Well, the guy that actually was investigating it from the Serious Fraud Office, well, he didn't even go and talk to one primary witness. You know, they put in the newspaper that this had actually happened. It was a lie. I know, because I went and spoke to all the companies involved. They were never approached by the police or the Serious Fraud Office. Instead, what happened? That guy is now a district court judge. Right? It's just amazing. And the issue is, the media just spent one moment looking at a person, doing a bit of background digging into the person, to find a lot of time that they would be shocked at what's actually going on. But the problem is, the average journalist walks in at 9 o'clock, he's got 3,000 words to actually pump out, and he no longer has the archive resources that he had, you know, 15 years ago. So he does a quick search on the internet, and if it didn't happen 10 years ago, it's probably not going to show up unless you've got the exact newspaper article in there. So, you know, as someone turned around and said, it's gloss once and move on, you know? There is no longer any depth to our media, and as members of the Fourth Estate, which is the whole part of that checks and balance systems, it's just simply not there.
It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. And that's what you need to do with propaganda, is just repeat it. Repeat it over and over again, because it doesn't exist. It doesn't exist.
There's an issue here too, and this is, you know, pretty radical, but when I was doing terrorism, like, you know, I looked at a paper once and looking at when has it become acceptable to use political violence. And, you know, the only conditions I could ever find that occurred is that basically when the authorities weren't only allowing you the process of due protest and reasonable ground to protest, but they were actually targeting you directly. Now, in New Zealand, we're getting laws such as our food bill, laws, our search and surveillance, and they're actually putting Kiwis in a situation where it's going to become a sleeping dog situation where people are going to respond in a negative way. Nobody ever benefits from that particular environment, but they have not simply given people the room to maneuver. And the lesson of history is quite clear. You put people in those conditions, they will bite back. You know, it's a shame because it doesn't have to be that way. We have good laws, and they simply have to be put into practice and given the accountability which we were told by our public representatives who we vote that we would receive. But it's just simply not actually happening. And again, you turn around, you know, I mean, vernacular is a very interesting thing. Some people talk about New World Order. Some people talk about, you know, sort of a global conspiracy theory. I sort of take the attitude of, at the end of the day, is that whatever word you want to use, there's, you know, 1% of the resources concentrated in the hands, or sorry, 99% of the resources concentrated in 1% of the hands. They all move in the same social net, same circles, and they move to advance themselves. So what we do see at the moment is a concentration of power that is designed to see that transfer of wealth from the poor to, you know, to the not so poor, and the end consequence of that is that, you know, people are just actually suffering from it. Yeah, David?
It's I think about kind of the 99% rather as more like the 99.9999%, because it's really only an incredibly small fraction of the population that's infinitesimal in terms of numbers who own virtually everything.
Oh,
that's
totally.
The real problem here. Look, hold on a sec, Ben. I just want to explain this. If somebody has $1 million, they're not part of the elite. If they have $10 million, they're still not part of the elite. If you have $1 billion, on the other hand, you're in, okay? People get angry with somebody's like driving around in a Mercedes-Benz or living in a $1 million home or anything. That's a person who's actually worked for it, who has busted their hump, built a business from scratch, and gotten it all done. Somebody, on the other hand, who literally lives in a palace and has more than five of them, that is not somebody who has earned that. That is somebody who has stolen it from not just one or two or three people or only a few major scams or anything like that. We're talking about somebody who scams the world on a regular basis.
And entirely, you know, I agree entirely with what you actually say there. I think it was about 2003 we found that when we looked at it was that the stats at that time was that 95% of the world's resources was in 5% of the world's population. However, of that 5%, 40% of that resources was controlled by less than 200 individuals. Today, that figure has shrunk, and you have even, you know, publications like New Scientist that basically say the same thing. When you actually look at it, you've got a very small amount of corporations that are actually controlling the vast majority of business interests in the world. And these guys lobby to put laws into place which don't provide capitalism to curb. In other words, the person that brings the best product to the market does, you know, gets the best price. They bring laws in which say, no, sorry, you're not allowed to bring your apples to the market. Only we're allowed to bring our apples to the market, and they're going to be GE-shaped apples, and they might even actually kill you in 5 years, but you've got to eat them because nobody else is allowed to sell these apples. You know, that's what we're up against. And so every time we get these MPs, I mean, you know, another thing I was going to sort of, the point that I was sort of leading back to beforehand is that, you know, whatever word you want to put it, you know, we look at New Zealand, and it's like, I look at the National Party, I look at the front row of the National Party, the front row of the Labour Party, and the front row of the Green Parties. All these guys belong to an organisation called Parliamentarians for Global Actions, formerly known, by the way, as Parliamentarians for a New World Order. These guys are all talking about, you know, one world currency system, one world legislation systems, but they're all actually also talking about doing them for systems which rely on aid, which is actually provided by the International Monetary Fund or World Fund, which is in turn financed by by big business. You know, when you turn around on one level, the Greens are turning around saying, you know, we don't believe in geoengineering, which, by the way, it's not something that they actively promote. It's only something that they'll say on an individual basis, and that's geoengineering. You say, fine, but you also support the Kyoto Emissions Trading Scheme, and the money that's going to be collected in for that is going to be used for geoengineering systems, which are not only have been proved not to work, but, you know, they will be used actually dumping toxic material. A good example is the giant blimps that are going to be operationing next year or doing trials next year in England. You know, these things are spraying sulfur dioxide for carbon sequestering. Sulfur dioxide is a byproduct of the coal industry, and these are the very same people that actually started off the whole concept of carbon trading, except for back then they called it futures weathers market, and they used it to build coal burning plants in the third world, which got given a subsidy and then pushed up the price of coal so that they actually got more profits for supply and demand. You know, they've rigged the system, and even the Greens, who should be looking more and more about where this money's going from and who's actually pulling the strings, they don't want to know about it. But then again, you look at the Greens, who are, you know, they're not a bad, I know a lot of people in the Green Party and a lot of MPs individually, but most of them are pretty good people. But you've also got people in those areas that are not facing the fact that in New Zealand, we no longer have MPs that are actually working for the country. We've got people that are educated in New US or UK-based universities. They go in there on scholarships, which are funded by organisations which have the origins in right-wing politics and, again, concentration of power. The end result is they're pushing agendas that are actually not the agendas that the New Zealand, average New Zealand person wants, but they're the agendas that suit big business. You know, you've got experts on global warming saying, why should New Zealand sign the Kyoto Protocol? Yet we went ahead and did it. And what actually happened was we were told at the time when we signed it that we'd make $1 billion profit if we signed it. That was by PricewaterhouseCooper. After we signed it, PricewaterhouseCooper turned around and said, sorry, and this is a direct quote, we made an accounting error. It's actually you're going to lose $1 billion. So they made a $2 billion accounting error. Now, what we find out is that when the
mission scheme goes... That's one heck of a margin of error. You know, imagine if somebody did a political poll and they say our political poll has a 200% margin of error.
No, it's absolutely ridiculous. And the whole system is that, again, instead of being, bear in mind, this is meant to save global warming, instead of turning around and saying to the local dairy farmer, tell you what, we'll give you a carrot if you grow hemp, we'll give you a carrot if you actually grow native plants and you can individually get the stuff. No, they don't actually get to keep those carbon credits. You know, only if you're in big business forestry do you get to actually keep this material. And in terms of who's actually going to be leading the carbon credit banking, guess what? It's going to be PricewaterhouseCooper, Fonterra, and my good friends in New Zealand. Now, the reason why I bring this up was that, you know, as a journalist, I'm not a scientist. I've been interested in global warming since, you know, I was in my 20s. I'm from a ski-based industry, so I do think there is climate change going on. I just happen to think the ETS is a dumb system. I would go to scientists and say, hey, this global warming happening.
Even Lord Christopher Monckton admits that climate change is going on. The difference being the climate change is naturally has been doing so for 4 billion years, and taxation or no taxation, it's still going to keep happening.
Oh, look, I mean, you know, I'm not going to get into that side of the argument, Vinny, because that's sort of I'm not agreeing or disagreeing, but the point I'm trying to actually make is that, you know, as a journalist, I would go to two experts, and this is pre Al Gore's An Inconvenient Truth. Before then, the scientists at the universities were all unequivocally, no, global warming's not actually happening. The science is still actually out. Postwards, they flipped around 360. The only thing that had actually changed was the source of funding. In contrast, you know, I had other experts that were saying, oh, no, global warming, you know, it isn't actually happening. So as a poor layman, I'd find myself looking at one expert and another expert crossing each other out. So as a journalist, I go back to the old trick of follow the money. And that's when I found out, guess who was the guys that actually told us that we'd make money? Guess who turned around and has actually given us a huge debt of $1 billion a year? And guess who's going to be making a huge amount of money when they start up the emissions trading scheme bank? Which is, by the way, both for why Labor and National are so keen, because they're both racing to be the ones to take credit for being the first country in the world to actually have an emissions trading scheme banking system. Like, their little fantasy is to turn New Zealand into the Switzerland of the carbon system, which is, you know, it's a Ponzi scheme that was designed and created by the biggest Ponzi people around, Enron.
Yeah, Enron and Al Gore, the two creators of the carbon tax scheme. Now, one of which is a incredible con artist organization who swindled bazillions, and the other is an incredible con artist man who got convinced everybody to follow a scam called NAFTA, which lost the US again. Squillions.
Oh, exactly.
So all you got to do is have a look at who's telling you, what their track record is, and that will basically give you at least a very good indicator about the level of truth that they're giving you.
And that's the thing which I find really interesting too, because, you know, back in the day when all the nationalists like denouncing global warming and saying that you're a quote unquote loony, or a green loony if you do, you know, back then they were dishing it. And that was people like Rod Arum, who was writing articles, you know, slagging off the Greens back in the 80s. Today, Rod Arum is part of a flying squad that's going around all the councils right now, and he's basically talking to the councils to show them how they can actually basically gouge their ratepayers for ET emissions. Because when an ETS comes in, it's not just you're going to get one simple flat rate. You're going to get charged once at a national level, then you're going to get hit by a local level, and then it'll probably also be put onto anything that you're going to buy in the shop will have an additional ETS cost into it as well. So you'll end up clicking that ticket three times. And on top of that, if you're a poor little farmer, and we're not talking one of the big guys, but we're talking about the little guys that have worked just 30 years for a shear milker, those guys, you know, they've got all of that, plus they've got increasing ACC levies. Then they've got, on top of that, they've got water privatisation, which is opening the floodgates for water privatisation for the whole country. The end result is those guys who are not the polluters will be pushed out, and the big boys will. But if they really were serious and they really wanted to combat global warming, they could say, hey, let's advocate hemp, the biggest carbon sequester on the planet. Let's also the most efficient form of biofuel. It's a $1 million crop. You know, 100 hectares will make you a $1 million crop. They could turn around and be using that as a bonus system and actually giving people a carrot to actually save the planet, but instead they're taxing us. How the hell are you going to tax? You know, it isn't going to save a single polar bear.
Well, no, not really. And in either case,
last for 10 years, not break down a year later.
Yeah. It's just basically a common sense thing. It's like, okay, has the internal combustion engine been obsolete for nearly 100 years? Yes! Then perhaps we should replace it. No! We want to keep the control of all the energy suppliers through all the world, through Rockefeller and Rothschild affiliated big seven oil companies. We want to buy up all our competitive oil companies, also incidentally buying out their refineries and then shut them down so that there's a bottleneck with oil production worldwide so that the price skyrockets, and ensure that the engines that everybody's putting that petrol into are completely inefficient and burn about 90% of it out of the exhaust pipe as unburned hydrocarbons. Isn't that a brilliant system, ladies and gentlemen? See, this is the thing. Global warming or not, there's still a giant international environmental crisis being caused by international banksters, oil tycoons, and various other forms of filth, the chief among which, and the scariest kind of biological security threat that I feel, is GMOs.
Totally. You know, and the other thing too is that, you know, relating to the whole issue of the carbon situation is, have you ever heard of a guy called Sir Robert Ogden and his visit? Do you know anything about him and his visit to New Zealand?
Nope.
Well, off the cuff, I think it was about 2010, Sir Robert Ogden, who in the United Kingdom is known as Mr. Coal because he's basically got all the main coal interests in the UK, also one of these guys that was financing the IMF and helped build these, you know, energy efficient coal plants that actually pushes profits up. He's got a boat called the La Masquerade. And the thing about this is that that boat was in Wellington, I think it was about 2010, 6 weeks before Copenhagen. Same boat turns up in Hawaii around about the time that John Key's also in Maui, along with about four or five other people who are really keen in promoting the whole greener movement. What was actually going on at the time was that, you know, around the world, the energy guys were actually actively lobbying governments and saying, hey, Copenhagen's failed. India and China actually said, no, screw you guys. We want to have the white picket fence and a roll-up watch and a car in the garage as well. So subsequently, it's either going to be us paying for the cost of Kyoto or the Western, you know, masses. Well, we as energy guys aren't going to do it. So what you're going to have to do is bring in a whole bunch of taxes, which are going to appeal to the middle class and to the wealthy people. But at the end of the day, basically, we want you to pass those costs actually onto them. And the thing is, these are things like, the water privatisation. You know, it's all stop cows shitting in the water. You know, that by itself, great. But when
we're broadcasting. Sorry, Ben, to cut you off there, but we're broadcasting on international airwaves, and you can't say those naughty words that you can't say on radio.
Apologies to the international airwaves. I do get a bit passionate, and I'll try to improve my etiquette a wee bit. So, you know, the short version is you've got these guys that are actually out there from the very origins that actually are the biggest polluters in the world, that are actually the ones that are actually advocating the whole issue of the Kyoto Protocol. It's absolute nonsense.
Yeah. Well,
I think it's
just
France that they've actually kicked it out because they've pointed out that it's the 95% of the largest polluters are the ones that aren't actually going to pay. And you know, the French attorney man said that all these proposals are just unconstitutional.
Hey, I was thinking just exactly how much control can be exerted through carbon taxes. And if you ever look at human activity, you can't actually name one that doesn't involve the emission of CO2. Doesn't matter whether you're house building, breathing, driving or producing food for people, it all produces CO2. So if you wanted control over the entire world and every single aspect of life or economic activity for any reason whatsoever, carbon dioxide would be the substance you would target.
Oh, entirely. And the thing is, you know, on that same process that, you know, you look at the, if you want to reduce the carbon emissions, you know, build houses that actually last over 100 years. And in England, they worked out that that alone would save them 40%. The reason they don't is because to have houses that last a long time is bad for your GDP. It's ridiculous. It's saving the world by accountancy, and it isn't going to work.
Saving the world by accountancy. Now, how can accountants fix any problem, you know? Well, what did Einstein say? He says the same level of consciousness cannot solve a problem that its original consciousness inspired, basically. And I think that people who keep talking about revolution, if anybody's driving to a car, you know, you've got a little needle on there that says RPM, revolutions per minute. That's what revolution means. It means to go in a circle. And that's what people are doing right about now, isn't it? All these revolutions that we've looked to throughout history, with maybe the exception of a very few genuine ones, have simply been instigated by the globalist. And the new revolution that's being brought about by the globalist is the quote-unquote green revolution, which is all about Codex Alimentarius and Agenda 21.
Well, I always actually have a little bit of a laugh, and I'll just sort of step back again. You know, when you generally look at traditionally look at revolutions, you know, what you'll find is that the ideologists come up with the ideas. As a generalization, they're the ones that end up with a pick in the back of their heads, and the hardcore guys actually move in. A good example of that one was the Russian Revolution, where, you know, Marx came up with these ideas, Trotsky came along, carried them forward, or, you know, sort of, and he got removed by Stalin. Lenin sort of came into the equation then, and then became the chief particular person with Stalin, later replacing him as actually the boss. Meanwhile, if you actually looked at where most of the finance came from Lenin, it didn't actually come from the revolution. It came from Henry Ford Motors, you know. And then when you turn around and look at the difference between, say, Marx and Leninism, you know, Marx always turned around and talked about a central committee but never defined it. His definition of Marx was, well, the central committee was a cross between Father Christmas, the Tooth Fairy, and the Easter Bunny. It was Lenin that turned around and said, actually, to have a central committee, you've got to actually have people based in industrialism, academia, and banking. Now, when you turn around and you look at the definition that is given for globalism today, that's actually the same, very same model. And I find it quite ironically, you know, we talk about this globalism and we say, oh, this is a great form of capitalism. It's not capitalism. It's just another form you know, I was going to say communism, but it's not. It's in all these cases, these isms, what is always boiled down to is who wins. It's the person that the bankers want to. You know, the great saying was Americans always
excuse. Well, more specifically, the person that the bankers finance. You have a look at the Russian Revolution. Exactly. Who financed it? The Rothschild banking cartel financed it. And even jump forward to today. Who financed Barack Obama's campaign? The same criminal banks, Goldman Sachs, and all that other stuff.
Oh yeah, and it's not just, you know, it's not just Obama. I mean, I'm not either for him against him. He's just another cut out paste. You know, it was Obama before that, it was Bush before that, it was Clinton before that. At the end of the day, all these guys, they don't get there unless they've got the money to actually back them. And, you know, you listen to Bill Hicks and the whole American dream of, you know, one day you will become the president. Well, that's not a reality unless you've got someone willing to give you $5 billion, which is, you know, we're talking big business. You know, you're not going to become the person that's representing democracy. And the same thing has actually happened in New Zealand today, where it's a case of it's not a case of the person who goes out there and canvasses the best is actually going to be the one that actually becomes elected. It's going to be the person that's getting, you know, that support of the corporate media. A good example is John Key gave MediaWorks a $46 million rent holiday on their frequencies. Suddenly MediaWorks is doing the official media coverage. They're controlling the camera angles, cutting out when people are speaking, moving the camera angles to who, you know, and all these things which can really alter the way that people serve perceptions, leading with which story, you know, giving us these polls that tell us that John Key is this far ahead, but not also point out the fact that there were things like bunch of people in Christchurch that couldn't phone into polls because of the Christchurch, the earthquake situation. You know, all these factors where they just manipulated the information, and what they were actually trying to do was say to get, and it worked, was saying to people, hey, don't bother going out and voting because it's a foregone conclusion. And that's exactly what happened.
We had the lowest voter turnout since like 1886.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely amazing. It was the election in New Zealand that was the most important one that required people to actually go out and actually vote. But they were just rammed home all the time that, oh, no, John Keyes is actually going to win the election. Yet, you know, when you actually looked at the polling results about 3 months beforehand, they told us that, you know, he was 61% or 58% in the polls. If you went back and you looked at the last election patterns, they actually had the same polling pattern. What happened on election day was they lost about 10 to 15%, which is, you know, pretty much what actually happened this year. And a very small fraction could have really radically changed this election. I mean, at the end of the day, only 38% of New Zealand actually voted for John Keyes. He isn't in there by a Democratic majority. He's in there because they managed to convince a large amount of people not to vote, and they managed to basically pretty much...
I was listening to talk radio, Ben, and you'll love this. Guy calls up and he says, well, you know what? I sleep better knowing that John Keyes is in charge of the country because he's such a lovely man.
Well, I had actually a similar thing.
Get this. The talk show host then asked him to elaborate, as in name one thing that indicates that he's a lovely man. The guy said, well, I just love John Keyes because he's a lovely man. He's got no information to even suggest an inkling of who he is, and yet absolutely so devoted, beyond any information to actually back up the case, so devoted that they will literally go to sleep being happy that he's in charge of the country.
Unfortunately, there is a vast majority of people that actually do go for slogans. You know, I remember walking into a bar one day and someone saying to me, oh, you know, it's really good that John Keyes is in because it was time for a change, which was actually the election slogan at the time. It's like, you know, he just repeated exactly what he heard. He didn't stop and think about it. Another case was, you know, I was talking to a voter from Epsom, which is a very wealthy electorate, and he turned around and he was going on about how much he hates banks and, you know, hates bankers. And I turned around and said, well, why are you voting for John Key? He's a banker. He said, oh, yeah, but he's such a nice guy. Yeah. I said, well, what do you know about John Key? You know, he said, oh, you know, he worked overseas. He said, but what else? He said, oh, really not that much. You know, all this material had been pumped out of the media. All his friends had picked up on it. He was responding to what his social peer group was. But when it pushed to come to shove, he didn't know anything about this guy. And, you know, for your readers, this is a guy that had left New Zealand in his teens. He's worked for the banks for 50 years. He hasn't lived in New Zealand. Suddenly he pops out of nowhere and we vote him as our Prime Minister. You know, he has no record of showing that he's actually worked for this country, has any interest in the country. And in actual fact, we know his working history was he speculated on our currency. He actually actively held our economy back. And this is the guy that the people who claim to be all business orientated voted in. Yeah.
And that's why I've called him, that's why I call him the Prime Sinister.
Yes, well, unfortunately, you know, if it wasn't John Key, it would be somebody actually else. But what it boils down to, again, is it boils down to the issue of the Fourth Estate. Because, you know, when I was talking about what was actually happening in Maui, and again, John popped off this year for about 8 weeks. You know, he had a state, went on holiday for 8 weeks. You know, he was at the rugby when the earthquake,
he went to Bohemian Grove.
But, you know, the thing is, I mean, you probably know this because you follow these things in your alternative, but where is everywhere else in the Western world where you've got the head of state and there's a little 6 feet behind him, there's a media pack, we've got a prime minister that can go anywhere and nobody ever actually asks when he goes overseas what he's doing, who he's talking to. They just let him wander off. And there is, you know, you're going, well, that's the whole purpose of the media, you know. And when you turn around and say, sort of suggest, like, you know, what's John Key been up to in Maui, you have all the right-wing bloggers going, don't be a snoop and your invasion of privacy. It's like, get real, guys. This is the job of the media. This guy is the head of state. He doesn't have privacy. He's the one that decided he wanted to be the prime minister. He gets all the perks, the limousines, the helicopter rides. You know, for 4 years that he's in, he doesn't get to have a private life. That's the whole point. He's working for us, you know.
Isn't that the banker code, though? All the perks, none of the responsibility.
Well, it's an interesting terminology because the word privilege actually is based in Latin. I'm slightly paraphrasing, but it literally means private law. You know, the difference between the medieval feudalist system, which you had privilege, but you also had noble obligatio, the obligation of nobility. Today's modern feudalism is all privilege and no noble obligatio. We have an elite that has no obligations to the people.
Well, they don't care about the people, do they? I mean, look, and it comes down to another thing. If voting could change anything, it would be made illegal.
Oh, you know, entirely. It's, but you know, at the end of the day, we also, sorry to use the cliche, we're also working in a cycle. And, you know, we've got to give a little bit of, you know, optimism to the situation. Was that, you know, Adolf Hitler once upon a time turned around and told us that there was going to be a 1,000-year Reich. Well, sorry, Hitler, that didn't occur. We can actually go up against these people. We've got the resources. We've got the ability. We're just going to have to work a lot harder. And unfortunately, for every single person like myself or yourself, Vinny, there is 100 other people that actually don't give a crap. But for me, I'm not too worried about them. For me, I've got nephews and nieces and people that I do care about and I do respect. I do it for them, and I have a lot of fun doing what I'm doing. You know, I have a really good lifestyle. You know, this is a good gig as far as I'm concerned. So, you know, sometimes it does wear you down a wee bit, but at the end of the day, I do believe in the process, and I do think we are capable of changing things around. And it may be that we don't actually get to win this battle, that things will get kind of harder before they get better. But, you know, that's another thing. We cannot expect – we've got to stop living this Bruce Willis syndrome where we expect the good guy to come riding over the horizon and save the day. This is a process that takes a lot of people working together, and it will take time.
Well, and it doesn't take actually too many people either, because if you have a look through history, any time that a genuine revolution has happened or a genuine government has gotten into power to overthrow a tyrannical one, it has virtually been at most a 3-4% minority that have actually made it happen. Okay, so don't worry if the masses don't support you, because the masses will follow whomever the shepherd that is placed in front of them happens to be. And ergo, the obvious solution is we need to place ourselves as the shepherds for the people and lead them onto greener pastures away from the New World Order controlled slaughterhouse.
Indeed. And, you know, another interesting point, which, you know, Bill Hick again refers to, and I'm sorry if I can mention him, but I do like him, but, you know, he mentions this whole particular point of people come along sometime, which is to point out the fact that, you know, we don't have to buy into their crap. We don't have to, you know, say, acknowledge that they have any more authority than you or I or the next person. You know, it's that whole concept of people like Gandhi, Martin Luther King. They didn't get rid of them because they're annoying. They got rid of them because of what they were saying was scaring the crap out of them. And we've got to actually really go back and look at the people that really did scare them and say, hey, what were these guys doing? Let's pick up and start using that model, because obviously it was working, because they wouldn't have done that in the first place if it wasn't because it was jeopardizing their power base.
The power base. Okay, now how do you actually deface that? Because I have come to the conclusion that our current Prime Minister, John Key, is basically just a personality cult. And if that personality is discredited and demonized in a truthful way, of course, and you don't have to make up stuff about John Key, you just have to find out the truth.
Basically,
All you got to do is just wait for that information to be as widely circulated as conceivably possible, so that it'll basically burst that bright, sparkling bubble for everybody and just say, look, I'm sorry, you're morons because you got deceived. In fact, no, I'm sorry. I don't want to insult people and call them morons. They're just, oh, my goodness.
It's
totally,
it's a situation.
Totally good, nice people aren't suspicious people in general, are they? We've
exactly.
got so many good people who are hard workers in this country who basically believe the things that are told to them by lying, psychopathic scumbags
because,
like the Prime
Minister. Because they wouldn't do that. You know, that's actually a very good point you hit there, Vinny, is that a lot of time the problem is people themselves are actually quite trustworthy, and they have trouble believing that this is going to happen because they wouldn't actually do that sort of thing in the first place. You know, the other issue, which is the sad side, but it's the reality, is if you look at the situation in South America and specifically Argentina, you know, until their economy actually collapsed, you had a large level of middle-class people that didn't pay attention to this stuff. They had their Coca-Cola, they had their McDonald's burgers. It was only when the things actually started directly impact upon them that they started to become interested. And, you know, they haven't entirely changed the situation, but they're holding the line. And I think the same situation in New Zealand. If you look at the history of New Zealand, we're one of the first countries in the world to allow females to actually vote. We've got a strong history of advocating humanitarian and social humanitarian practices before the rest of the world. I have faith in New Zealand. Problem is, it's going to take things getting harder before the average Kiwi really starts to realize that this is actually something that they, you know, it's not going to go away. It's not something on the other side of the hemisphere. It's something that they have to deal with. Our job is to try and, like, get as many of those guys waking up as quickly as possible. The reality is there will be hard times. So that it's just, you know, mathematics points out where it's going and what's going to happen. But, you know, give us the opportunity to start for people to start seeing firsthand, and I think things will change. And you know, there's been a lot of things going around the world where it shows you that you know that the powers that be don't always actually have control of the situation. And the Occupy movement is a good example of that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've always seen humanity as kind of the wild card in every situation, particularly the individual. And when you think about the collective or whatever, it doesn't actually exist. The only thing that exists is the individual. You know, like an individualist could say, frack the collective, okay? And he would actually be saying a good thing, because what he's doing is saying every single person that exists has their own rights that cannot be taken away. Everybody has the ability to fight, to live, to breathe, to love, to enjoy life, okay? Whereas a collectivist saying, frack the individual, what they're also doing is saying, frack the collective too.
Yeah, well, that gets into the whole realm of, you know, another interesting aspect about politics is that a lot of time people will approach something and they'll come up with, they're either pro-capitalism or pro-communism or left-wing, right-wing, same turkey as far as I'm concerned, but they will pick on one thing and assume that one size fits all. The reality is politics is a continually adjusting process, and, you know, you look at a good example of that is during World War II, we had Winston Churchill. Now, he was a very right-wing, very dogmatic leader. The people of Britain had the good sense to get rid of Winston Churchill at the end and bring in somebody that actually suited those conditions. And I think constantly when people are looking at it, you know, sometimes the individual is right, sometimes the group have got to work together. But as soon as you entrench yourself into one thought process, you know, you're lost. And I always like Robert Wilson, who wrote fantastic books, The Cosmic Conspiracy and Illuminatus. You know, he says it's actually okay to believe in me or to consider many belief systems. It's when you hold on to one thing, that's when you're trapped. And so I think there is a little case of being open-mindedness, looking at every process. It's the art of deduction, and unfortunately, a lot of people actually don't do it. They form a view of the world that the world is like this. They apply all those models of working things actually out according to the world is actually this. Whereas, you know, you follow the old Sherlockian Holmes of, you know, sometimes what you've actually got to do is consider the plausible, and when the plausible is no longer applicable, that's when you consider the improbable, because we do live in a very interesting world, a very interesting universe. I don't claim to know the answers, both on a political level and on the bigger picture. But I try to be open-minded, and I try to use these methodological approaches when I'm approaching any issue I'm working on. And as again, I look at my history and my hindsight, and I think I've actually had that approach has worked for me very, very well.
We'll have to stop it right there, Ben, because we have to take a wee bit of a break to play a song called Desire by Holly Riggs. I want to thank you, Ben, for coming on today. Ladies and gentlemen, if you want to check out his website, it is postmanproductions.org. That's postmanproductions.org. Thank you very much, Ben.
My pleasure. Thank you very much again, Benny.
We don't want to.
1923strike.com radio on the second Saturday of every month for our live international radio marathon. Don't buy, don't comply, ask why. UWS strongly promote the use of grassroots patriot music. Please drop us a line and we'll play your music.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to Malignant Humour. I'm your host, Vinnie Eastwood, and we have a very special guest, Susie from the Occupy Auckland media team, joining us now via phone. Susie, welcome to the program.
Thanks, Vinnie.
Now, I got a message from my mate, Rainbow Whitty. Can you explain a little bit about what's just happened down at Occupy?
Well, my understanding of that text message was just, to be honest, that someone had freaked out a bit because their laptop was stolen and they had quite a bit of information on it. However, they've gone through the normal channels to report that and hopefully we'll get it back. As far as we're concerned, things have actually been more unified than ever. We've had the amazing founding of the Occupy Albert Park, which is our fourth simultaneous 24/7 occupation in Auckland, New Zealand. And to be honest, things have been really good.
Okay, so there's no emergency.
No, I think it was definitely an emergency for the person involved because that was a very important laptop to them. But I think, you know, the text message was just sent under the heat of the moment.
Yeah, yeah, okay. Well, I can understand that one. All right, in that case, phew, wipe the sweat off the brow. Now, speaking of which, you haven't actually received any opposition quite so much in terms of the other Occupy movements in the world, have you? You know, no pepper spray, no tasers, or any of that kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, to the contrary, we've had police openly in support of us. We had a submission made by the New Zealand police to the district court, actually in support of our rights under the Bill of Rights to peacefully assemble and to peacefully protest. So, to be honest, the cops have been brilliant so far, and I can't really say enough for them.
Yeah, yeah, well, that's the good thing about the New Zealand police, isn't it? As long as they have a Masonic checker around their caps, it's all good. We have a problem in this country where there's a bad perception of police in general, but in my experiences, having been arrested twice and maybe having to talked to cops just on a normal basis, probably maybe close to 100 times or so, always generally found them to be quite reasonable and decent blokes and can't find fault.
From my personal perspective, just in my own experiences, I think that there may be a big difference between the state of New Zealand police in, say, the 80s to the 90s to the 00s and to now, because I can see that there has been what I would consider to be some cultural shift within the police force to be a bit more community-minded and a bit more open and tolerant. For example, I was astounded, actually, that an inspector at Auckland Central Police actually allowed me to put him on record in an article about the New Zealand police position on Occupy. And he actually allowed me to use his name and gave me direct quotes. And for me, that's a sign of openness that I wouldn't even have expected from them. So to me, they really maybe are working towards safer communities together.
Yeah, yeah. It always seems to be an irony kind of thing because the, I don't know. The thing about being a police officer is that you're basically a tool of the state to enforce whatever the state's will is. And it is usually when the police actually act to the contrary of the will of the state that you can really, really see the truth and the light and the goodness kind of flow out of them. And it's the same thing that's happened here, you know, the judiciary and particularly the, what's it called, the Auckland City Council have been quite nasty to the Occupy movement and wanted to send the people that are in Altair Square to jail and that kind of thing. And I noticed that when the Occupy movement was supposed to be evicted from Altair Square the day before, what was it, Christmas Eve, not one cop showed up to enforce that eviction notice.
Well, I think there may be a presumption from the council that because they may see themselves as the state, as you said, the police are to enforce the will of the state. But really, city council bylaws aren't the will of the state, that's the will of the council. And so the police may not feel, I can't speak for them, obviously, this is just my opinion, but they may feel that they're not actually security guards for the council, that they're not actually there to act on behalf of the council, that they are, as you say, to act on behalf of the state. And right now we're in the position where, after 3.5 months of protest, we have had no serious governmental, national recognition of the movement or of what we're trying to achieve here. The councils, as far as I'm concerned, have been a diversionary tactic because the longer that we're seen as being in opposition to the council, the longer that they can go on without recognising that this is national legislative change that is required and that it can't be achieved by the council.
Well, I seem to take it a bit further and say that it's actually international legislation that needs to change because, after all, it's not just the scumbaggery here at home that Occupy stands against. It's a lot to do with international corporations taking over the country.
The corporatization of government, yeah, local and foreign. I mean, that's what we're seeing here now at a local level with the council. The council is essentially a corporate board. You've got it run by someone on $750,000 a year who has 30 years' experience in the corporate world. They're setting up the CCOs and the corporate arms of the council. For example, when we wanted to access power and water in Aotea, we were told that we had to fill out this ridiculously long form and we had to go through all of this red tape, and at any stage it could be denied to us. And I actually had an off-the-record conversation myself with a council member who I won't name, but I was saying to him, you know, these things are human rights. These, prior to there ever being councils or national governance, people had the ability to go to the stream and get their water. People had the ability to create sources of their own power. So how is it that when we are protesting, when under the Bill of Rights and under, you know, our core values, how is it that we cannot access power and water without going through a corporate channel? And he said to me, oh, well, user pays. And I said, well, we're happy to pay for it, but that's not the purpose. We just don't feel that we should need dictated to us by this corporate arm whether or not we can access what essentially comes down to being human rights.
Human rights are not something that you can gain easily, but certainly they can be taken away quite quickly, especially if nobody resists. What's happening now, I feel, and I think Rainbow Witty kind of said this best, is that Occupy represents sort of the immune system of the planet, okay? Criminal banksters, I see them as more or less just a form of viral weaponry being injected into the financial veins of this world, and they've begun to try and destroy every single healthy red blood cell that exists. Occupy the white blood cells attacking back and defending the body from this menace. Do you agree with that analogy?
I do think that's a good analogy. I think someone else described it as a happy virus. Occupy is a happy virus. It spreads like a virus, but it brings happiness.
Just talk it to
for
my
me, it's a bit more. For me, it's a bit more black or white. I mean, people say to me all the time, what is your one demand? And I say, well, what is the one demand of any time that people come together in public protest against the government? The demand is the overthrow of the corrupt. It is the removal of the corrupt. And that is precisely what Occupy is about. We're trying to say, hey, there is corruption. We know there's corruption. We have info from here to Africa to show that there is corruption. So please recognize it and please stand with us so that we can do something about it, because merely ignoring it and continuing on is just not an option.
Yeah. I mean, I think it was Ayn Rand who famously said, you can ignore reality, but you can't ignore the consequences of ignoring reality.
And that's exactly where we find ourselves now, because we're at irreparable damage stage. And I just hope to see the day in New Zealand where we hit critical mass of people in the way that has happened overseas. And I think then that is the day that we'll begin to have real change in this country.
I think that's a good place to leave it, Susie. And by the way, we have just received a word from Karen Testardo, who runs this monthly broadcast on UnitedWeStrike.com that goes out internationally, that they'd like you to be popping in on a monthly basis just to give a quick little report and updates, as you've done here, if you'd be willing.
Oh, excellent. Thank you. Someone from the media team certainly will. We run a non-hierarchical structure and we rotate through the positions. But there are plenty of awesome people that have awesome things to say on our media team, and definitely one of us would love to speak with you whenever you're able.
Okay, cool. Well, just send that information through to me, to my Facebook, and then we will get all the contacts and necessary organization done.
Excellent. Thank you so much. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, Susie. You're very welcome.
Okay, bye.
Bye. Oh, ladies and gentlemen, Occupy is an international movement, and we've just heard from the Kiwi media team, known only as Susie. You can check her out on Facebook. It's Susie, O-W-S-D-A-W-S-O-N, and that should be sufficient for you all there. Now, Occupy in Wall Street, obviously where it started, there have been quite a lot of controversies surrounding Occupy, saying, oh, it's controlled opposition, this, it's controlled opposition, that. But the fact of the matter is, unless you're been asleep this whole century, there's a heck of a lot of bad stuff going down that they actually happen to be addressing. And we have Karen Quinn Tostado on the line here, and I think she can probably concur and even elaborate on that. Karen, welcome.
Hi, Vinny. I just want to say thank you for bringing the Occupy movement to United We Strike and our peace train. That is awesome. We have, from the very beginning, been hoping for that type of movement, and now that we are making contact, we're going to have to see in the future if what we can do is marry that Occupy spirit to the United We Strike peace train and have the people who feel compelled to go to their government officials and take the time to do that, to go to more of the senators and the congresspeople. Those people can do that, and those of us who feel like taking local action, if we took that and combined it and did that at the same time, how powerful would that be?
See, and again, it doesn't take a cast of thousands, does it, Karen? There's only a small amount of people, relatively speaking to the size of the population, that are even behind this United We Strike broadcast, similarly with Occupy Wall Street, and similarly with the Occupy movements all around the world. And I did, in fact, have my affiliate station manager down in the South Island of New Zealand, Aussie Greg Selman, give me the report on that. 2,300 cities have currently got an Occupy movement. So it's global. And I've never, ever seen anything like this, bar none. It just hasn't happened before, has it?
2,300 cities, did you say, Vinny, globally?
Yeah.
That is great. See, the people do want to wake up. And now that is where I am getting chills, because when we let them know, and we're going to have to put something out, you know, GWS 2012 Peace Train and the Occupy movement, get on board, because then we can go local. We can combine strikes with movements, mass movements on huge government officials, on local officials. We can have teams out all across the globe, and this year is going to be wonderful.
Yeah, everybody get on the peace train and choose peace.
That's it. Get on the peace train, choose peace.
And if you're against the peace train, we will chew you up.
No, this is a great opportunity. And it is a lot of people in conversations throughout the chat room all day long here in the Skype. The energy is just palpable. People are waking up all over. And I've discovered also that we're being streamed on stations we had no idea of. There's a 12160 blog that I belong to, and I periodically send things in. And I was so busy I wasn't able to do it, but they have a link going, and they're playing our marathon. They have a chat room going. These new hosts have chats from the Wolf Spirit Radio and my brain is so fried I can't remember the rest of them. But
you've been up for quite a long time, haven't you, Karen?
Well, not as long as Rick.
we got Rick, our producer here, incredibly hard working behind the board. And last time I spoke to him, he was like, ugh. You know, kind of like, have you ever seen like the Frankenstein movie kind of thing? And not entirely dissimilar from that, except he doesn't have the electrical brain surge thingy going on, because the synapses are kind of shutting down one at a time. Might have something to do with
that. Yeah, but that was about 4 hours ago. I was like that. You know, I'm on a whole new stage now, you know.
Hey, well, apparently the longer you go without sleep deprivation, the more awesome the trip becomes.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Well, are you going to test it out? Because this is our last day now of the marathon coming up tomorrow.
Well, I've got to admit, we've got to wrap it up because, you know, there's this pink elephant kicking in my back door, and I'm going to have to do something soon about it.
All right. Well, Vinny, thank you very much. And all the listeners out there and the people in the chat room and everyone across this planet individually who is supporting us, one heart, one mind at a time, freedom. None of us have to be subservient to the others. We never have to be beaten or put down or made to pick up guns and murder people we don't know because somebody else is telling us we have to do that. It's nice time for us all to lay down our arms and to recognize that together we need to clean up this mess and get rid of the corruption. And it's time to stop being duped, turn the tables. United we strike, we can do it peacefully. Thank you, Vinny, very much for being such a big part of this. Thank you, Rick. Thank you, everyone. And this time, I mean it, I'm going to go to sleep, but I'll be up bright and early tomorrow for the third and final round of our United We Strike 2012 Peace Train.
Well, yeah, well, hang on.
I just need to shamelessly.
We're not over yet. There's still two more shows left to go.
Oh, there is. There's Siobhan. Siobhan, she's probably in the other room going, you know, Karen, I liked you until then. It's humanity transcending. Obviously, this humanity has been descending. But sorry if we. It's a great website. Siobhan is knowledgeable on geoengineering and all sorts of other things. And right now I've been thinking, talking, I'm tired, I'm pooped. Good night, all.
Well, let's bring Siobhan on then. And ladies and gentlemen, you can check out my show at thevinnyeastwoodshow.com. It's 5 days a week, 2 hours a day. It's the lighter side of genocide, because in the world so full of chaos and madness, if you lose your sense of humor, you'll go freaking nuts.
I just get that right. You said fracking, right? I thought that's what you said.
Fracking, yeah.
Actually, we should get Siobhan in here because she's still up in the other room and she was going to go sleep early, and that way I can tell her I'm sorry. I was dissing her again.
Okay, give me
and Vinny, she's
a
loving your choo-choo-choo's piece.
Oh, yeah.
Now, Vinny, what time is it in the future?
It is 12 past 7 p.m. on Sunday, the 15th of January.
And it is 10:12 p.m. Pacific time in Oregon, California, on the 14th still of January.
Yeah, so it's basically like 3 hours ahead and a whole day behind.
And then, Rick, what time is it?
Oh, it's 6:15 in the morning here. The sun's going to be coming up in a minute. Hey, look, I'm really everything's double vision, and it's a lot of work to try and type in a new. Can you drop the contact into this room just to save me a bit of ease? I would type it, but, you know, that'll take me a while. Oh, there we go. There. Nice.
I'm sorry, Rick. You know, we do need to say goodbye. We'll get her in, and so she can...
No, it's fine.
Well, at least then she'll know that we really mean it, and we are going to play her tape, and this is perfect. I'll lay down and listen to her soothing voice, and then I am going to sleep. And Vinny, you still have lots to do today, huh?
Yeah. Well, I'm still awake and still alive and in charge and what have you. So if you still need me to stay on to co-host with Siobhan or anything, you know, I can't, because the missus is basically, she wants to spend some time with me. It's Sunday. It's her only day off, and she needs to get her forehead kissed and get snuggled.
That sounds like a priority.
Mm-hmm.
Always good.
And I'll make her some popcorn too.
Yep, get that organic popcorn. It's the best.
Incidentally, yes, we actually do have organic popcorn, and I pop it myself on the stovetop, you know, none of that microwave crap.
No, it's supposed to be bad for you.
Well, anything in a microwave is actually bad for you. Like, people don't know that microwaves were actually invented by the Nazis. That's why the Nazis were able to move their ground forces around so quickly, is because they used microwaves to cook all the troops' food using the radio equipment, and they didn't have to lug around so much cooking equipment like gas stoves, portable LPG canisters, all of that kind of stuff. So they're able to be a much better mobile force. And I think it was in the early 70s that a Scandinavian study did a test on 10 students, getting them to eat 3 microwave meals a day, and they had to cancel the trial after day 10 because every single one of them was starting to get, wait for it, adult-onset leukemia. As a direct result of that study, Russia in the 70s, communist Russia, you know how they slaughter millions of people and stuff like that and confiscated all the food off the Ukrainians and killed about maybe 9 million of them, right? Even they outlawed microwaves as, quote, a public health risk. The way microwaves work is they vibrate the cells, and they vibrate at such a speed that it actually rips open the cells themselves of the food and corrupts the DNA structure of it, so that when it's being passed through your digestive system, your body cannot recognize what it's digesting, and those cells basically sit in your lower gut and turn into cancer.
Ah.
So now you know. Don't microwave your baby formula.
Or your poodle.
You suck it till they're blue in the face. You know.
No, I had not heard that, but I had heard that there was an experiment done by one of the lower grade schools now And he took water and he microwaved it and he let it cool. And he watered his plant, and he watered another plant with just tap water. And the plant that was watered with the microwaved water died. So apparently your theory is right on, and that explains what happened to that poor plant, too, trying to absorb things that it just did not could not recognize.
Yeah, absolutely. And when you're trying to absorb things that you can't recognize, the logical conclusion is, hey, it's actually not possible to absorb it, right? Like, for example, the Prime Minister of New Zealand wants me to recognize that selling state assets is a good thing, and that just doesn't compute because it doesn't make any sense, and it's just a fraud. And I can't process it no matter how hard I try. I've tried to swallow it. I've tried to gargle and rinse twice, and it still doesn't make any sense to me. I still can't swallow it. My gag reflex is going strong, you know. State asset sales.
if you stay on the line together, I'll elaborate on that same thing. Hold on.
Uh-oh. Oh, no. Pressing buttons.
Here comes Rook's gag reflex.
No, I've got
it. In fact, isn't that what people happen when – that's what happens to people when I tell a joke or a gag on the show. They have a reflex action to it. Which is why, you know, when you tell the truth, you offend both sides of every argument, don't you? The left and the right, which are both lies. So, ergo, the person who's coming up the middle telling the truth gets demonized by both sides. Isn't that great? It's like a political system.
Here, come with the gag again. What was that? It makes you go... Oh, Vinny, that's...
Part of it looks like...
That actually did make me feel a little bit ill. Thank you, Rick.
Well, I'm just glad it didn't get on me. And Siobhan said a long time ago she was going to sleep. She was chatting until now. I said that too. And sorry to put you guys through that. She's sleepy. I'm sleepy. Vincent, thank you. Leaving it in capable hands of you and Rick. And we're
well, you
off
get
it.
you get some sleep, Karen, and do we have somebody to line up and do the producing on behalf of Rick so we can get some sleep too? I mean, I'm still awake and alive and kicking and whatnot, and I can go without guests or anything like that and just keep on going and going and going. So don't worry about me.
I think he was popping in that program, but again, that's you guys. And
I was just going to make the
that's a good idea.
The next couple of hours, because. You know, otherwise I'm not going to be awake for the morning production. We're going to start again in the morning in a minute.
Mm. Okay, well, I'll just introduce this one then and read out the protocol on it. The clip that we're going to be playing, ladies and gentlemen, is an episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show that aired on January the 13th. This is Vinnie's nutshell. What dangerous cargo was the Rena carrying when it slammed into the Astrolab reef? Why are PR representatives and the media being so cryptic about it? Investigative journalist Ben Vigens blows the lid on this incredible cover-up and the massive health implications of this disaster. The Christchurch quake. Was it man-made? HAARP phenomenon, chemtrails, disaster drills on the day of the September quake, the head of FEMA staying behind to coordinate the disaster after 9 US congressmen stepped on a plane 2 hours before it hit. This is one of the most groundbreaking shows I've ever done, and I've literally got chills. And you can check out that also at the Vinnie Eastwood Show. .com, and it's posted as an archive linklet on guerrillamedia.co.nz as well. So, Rick, if you want to get that playing underway, we can say fare thee well, and thank you very much to the United We Strike audience.
I'm just going to add, Vinny, that will be the clip that it will be on after. So, I don't want to say this right, but I don't know if I will. I'm going to go with Siobhan.
Siobhan. It looks like she's gone to bed, Rick.
I'm going to play it anyway because it was supposed to be played earlier, so it's going to go through. So we've got 1 hour. So that's about an hour interview, and then the clip that you did is coming up in the hour after.
Yeah, indeed. And again, ladies and gentlemen, thank you very much. And we appreciate all the people that show their support to the United We Strike broadcast at unitedwestrike.com, especially all the other affiliates and other radio people that involve themselves in this broadcast every month. And of course, there is a very, very strong, dedicated, and incredibly talented team behind the scenes here who literally shed some tears and blood and sweat in order to keep this little choo-choo-choo's piece train running.
On that note, it's been a pleasure, and good night.
You're listening to UnitedWeStrike.com Radio on the International Community Radio Network.